Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Today on the show, Senator Barrasso wants to find ways to address forest fires. The state of Wyoming is following the issue closely.
What we see from wildfires are concerns from our tourists, as well as our citizens.
For the first time, the government let a Native American tribe exhume the graves of boarding school children so they could be given a proper funeral.
We honor him, we love him, we still care for you as this little boy who's coming back.
The University of Wyoming is hoping students will help prevent sexual violence, but those messages don't always sink in.
Now I'm like so fired up about like wanting to be that like reminder of how it happens.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wildfires have dominated headlines in much of western Wyoming this summer. Senator John Barrasso chairs the Senate Environment Committee, and this week held a hearing on a string of bills that proponents say will help keep those catastrophic wildfires at bay. But Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that some people say that lawmakers are trying to do too much.
To Barrasso and a bipartisan group of senators, the problem is clear. Catastrophic wildfires are man-made. Well, more precisely, made by the inaction of man and all the red tape of environmentalists.
Decades of fire suppression and a rapid decline in active management have led to overly dense forests susceptible to disease and to pest outbreaks. Pests or disease leave thick stands of dead trees, which are poor habitat for iconic species such as elk, lynx, deer, and other wildlife that depend on vibrant forest ecosystems.
The bills Barrasso's committee is examining range from loosening environmental restrictions that force forest management projects to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service to another that would exclude more acreage from environmental reviews. Barrasso says something needs to be done to allow people to clear forests of brush more easily.
What's most egregious is that our federal land managers could mitigate a significant portion of these risks. Fire is a historically important part of an ecosystem, but these large, unnatural, catastrophic wildfires are not. In order to address this threat, we need to actively manage forests with excess dead wood. Large stands of dead trees need to be removed in a timely fashion so we are not facing another 8 million acres of burned lands.
Without those changes, proponents say the nation's western forests will continue to burn. Jessica Crowder, a policy advisor for Governor Matthew Mead, told the committee Wyoming residents face health risks if nothing is done.
Human health is certainly a concern when it comes to wildfires. The air quality in Wyoming has been particularly bad this summer. Particulate matter, or those particulates that are suspended in the air, really do cause damage. The Wyoming Department of Health has put out several announcements and warnings to Wyoming citizens over the past several months, warning them to stay indoors and close their windows.
Crowder says Wyoming's economy is also at risk if nothing is done.
We have several of these reserved forests and wilderness areas and national parks that people enjoy visiting. We have several places throughout our state that people love to go fish. They love to go hike. They love to get on the Snake River and raft. What we see from wildfires are concerns from our tourists, as well as our citizens, that they won't be able to do those things that they really want to do.
While Democrats on the Environment Committee are usually at odds with the GOP on many issues, there wasn't much pushback from the minority party on forest policy. That rankled environmentalists like Brett Hartle, the government affairs director for the Center for Biological Diversity. He says it's been hard to be vocal this summer as millions of acres burned.
This issue has been a tough one in the sense that, you know, especially when the West is still on fire, you know, it's hard to say, you know, to be a voice saying, let's comply with our environmental laws, you know, rather than just doing anything.
Hartle says a lot of this could be mitigated if Congress only funded the Forest Service properly.
The Forest Service, the land management agencies, have been operating on flat budgets for many, many years, which don't take into account, you know, just realities of life, right? I mean, people, cost of living goes up, salaries have to go up. A flat budget is effectively a cut to many agencies.
While testifying in favor of the bill to streamline forest management, Colin O'Mara, the president of the National Wildlife Federation, told senators that the new bills may not be necessary if Congress actually spent more money on forest management, which he says current law already allows.
You can have all the management tools in the world, but if you don't have the resources to get projects on the ground, they're all for naught. And I think right now, when you're spending $2 billion between the Forest Service and BLM and the Interior agencies on fighting these catastrophic fires, and that doesn't include the money that the Pentagon's spending and some state agencies are spending on top of it. And so it's a massive number.
O'Mara is calling for a separate savings account of sorts for Western states prone to wildfires.
My belief is that we should have a dedicated separate fund for fires rather than trying to put it into the FEMA universe, because if there's another hurricane that hits New York or Delaware or somewhere else, I mean, those funds are not predictable enough, so there should be a separate funding source.
Still, the Republican majority in Washington doesn't seem to want to dole out many more dollars for forest management. That's why Senator Barrasso says these three bills to streamline forest management are necessary.
We must act quickly to address the risk to human health, infrastructure, and valuable ecosystems. There are millions of acres of federal land, forest land, in dire need of thinning, restoration, and other attention.
With most of the nation's lawmakers still focused on the devastating hurricane damage in Puerto Rico, Texas, and Florida, it's unclear when Barrasso will be able to bring these forest management bills to the floor. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Since January, President Trump has ordered systematic rollbacks of Obama-era environmental regulations. He's voiced an intent to focus on energy development and jobs over environmental regulation. Many of these rules were crafted by Obama's Environmental Protection Agency under Gina McCarthy. She was EPA administrator during his second term. They focused on taking steps against climate change. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim spoke with McCarthy during her visit to Wyoming and gets her reaction to these changes.
Can you talk about how you felt when the administration started mentioning a more systematic rollback and employing a more systematic rollback? Were you surprised at all?
Well, all I will say is that I was surprised by sort of that there was no more discretion put towards what do I like, what do I don't like, what should happen, what shouldn't, what does the law require, what is the science telling us? Because they so quickly said everything's going, you know, and so there was not a really thoughtful process. And I think it's important to have that. I think that's the role that a new administration has, is to do a thoughtful look. And I think there are always going to be policy swings, different judgments. But this administration is questioning the science itself and in ways that really make life very unpredictable, I think, for all of us, including the business community, which is now facing significant uncertainty with all of the changes that are being proposed. But I think people ought to understand that you can't, no matter who you are, you can't come in and make pronouncements. Everybody in the United States has their role in government and their authorities. And in order for EPA to be rolling back rules, they have to do a rulemaking in order to make that happen.
So states like Wyoming have a lot of people who aren't particularly sad to see some of these regulations loosening, leaving more room for economic development. How do you feel about that?
So we did not do anything that should pit the effort to reduce greenhouse gases in any way against the economy, because we were following the way that the energy market was working. Today, no matter what anybody in this administration says, renewable energy is both clean and marketable. Right now, there is no strong market for coal in the United States of America. That has been a trend that has been happening since the 80s. And we know that renewable energy is here to stay. Clean energy is where the economy is moving, where the jobs are growing. So we have to figure out how to break through the rhetoric and look at the real facts of how you do rules and recognize that you can have and you must have both a strong economy and good environmental protections.
So, like you've said, a lot of this will be caught up in court. It's not necessarily going to be an easy thing to rescind these regulations. So I'm I'm wondering if you think these rollbacks are going to have a long-term impact.
You know, I don't think so. I don't think they will have long-term impacts. You know, I'm pretty confident that we did what we needed to do correctly, and that if it goes to court, if they don't do things right, they will lose. And I think the courts won't be happy with how busy they are, because that's not how government is done. Unless there is a flaw, unless we got the science wrong, unless we didn't follow the law, then the administration needs to articulate a solid reason why government would change its position. And if they cannot do that, then they will not be successful. And so far, I'm not hearing, you know, anything even close to that type of rational approach that is required under the law.
So while these rollbacks are widely supported by the fossil fuel industry and many others here in Wyoming, there's also a lot of folks that I know are concerned. So what should they do to make sure their concerns are heard?
Well, I would tell them that I've been in this business for 37 years and that there are ebbs and flows and things. And I admit that this administration makes things a lot more uncertain than I think any other. And so we are seeing a lot more energy at the state and local level. We're seeing a lot more business interest in recognizing things like climate change and the need to act and what an economic threat that climate change poses. So the world is not going to end. We have to speak up. We have to be active. We have to be positive. We have to get back to talking with one another. And getting back to a good understanding that everybody needs clean air and clean water, and we need a stable climate and a good place and home to live, a safe one and a healthy one. Let's just focus on that for a while. Let's talk to one another and figure out how to get there again together. Don't let today divide us. Let it bring us together and energize us.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
When we come back, we'll discuss foreign policy and hear from a Wyoming filmmaker. This is Open Spaces. We cannot bring you shows like Open Spaces without your financial support. We invite you to begin or renew your support for award-winning public radio right here in Wyoming. Stay informed, support fact-based journalism, and keep public radio strong in Wyoming. You can pledge now online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The Jackson Hole Wildlife Film Festival attracted an international audience this week for what many call the Oscars of Nature Film. Finalists included Wyoming filmmaker Shane Moore. Moore started making films when he was just 12 and growing up in Granite Creek, which is 30 miles southeast of Jackson. He met pioneers of nature shows, including Wild Kingdom and Walt Disney on his family ranch when they came to film. Moore was a finalist for two films this year, Born in China and Ghost of the Mountains. Both feature the rarely seen and rarely filmed snow leopard. Rebecca Huntington has more.
When film company Brian Leith Productions set out to film snow leopards in China, they dubbed it Mission Impossible. No one had ever filmed snow leopard cubs in their natural environment. For this assignment, they turned to Jackson filmmaker Shane Moore. And Moore, he likes a good challenge.
I've never worked in a place where the mountains don't have names, the rivers apparently don't even have names.
We haven't seen snow leopard in the flesh. We've seen almost everything, but that's a big gap.
So we were on the Tibetan Plateau, and we started into the field with a team, and no one on the team had actually ever seen a snow leopard. And I have to admit, I was really deeply worried about complete failure.
I read that the snow leopard started to recognize or maybe get more comfortable with you as you were there so long. Is that true?
Yes, they did. I mean, the snow leopards, after a while, became much less concerned about us, and I was really thrilled about that, and I was tried to impress upon everyone on the team that, you know, we needed to be respectful of their space the entire time. And, you know, that was so tempting to maybe have a situation where we might want to try and sneak up. But well, we really avoided that temptation because we knew we'd be there for the long haul. And if they learned to trust us, it would pay off in the end. And I think it really did. By the end, we would have these cats sleeping within 100 yards of us and you know we're there and not be concerned. And that's when things start to get good, when they start doing completely normal behavior.
Can you share one example with us?
And it was thought that they're highly territorial, that, you know, a male would have a large territory with maybe several females that would be in his territory, but they really didn't tolerate one another very well. And we started to see things that just didn't fit that picture at all. We saw them sharing kills. And we saw four different snow leopards come in on a kill and they would rotate through, seemed to get along very well. So it's a little more complex social structure than I would have ever guessed.
Did you see similarities to, say, mountain lions in Wyoming?
The snow leopards, I think, are very similar to mountain lions in Wyoming. They have the same strategies for hunting. They use the cliffs in the same way, a lot of parallels. They both have that really long tail that's so great for balance when they're chasing animals in a difficult environment. But I have to say, I mean, I really felt bad for the snow leopards in the end because we saw them hunting on a lot of occasions. I think I saw over 30 hunts. I only saw them on a couple of times when they caught newborn lambs, but I never saw them succeed, you know, chase down an adult blue sheep, which is really pretty extraordinary. It's hard. It's hard to make a living up there. The prey is incredibly wary. And one of the things that really amazed me about the Tibetans that we worked with is their tolerance for predators. Like Wyoming, they live in an area and there's brown bears up there, there's wolves and snow leopards, and they all predate their livestock. I think when the snow leopards get desperate and they may be near starvation is when they'll come in and take an animal. And that's kind of similar to what might happen in Wyoming.
You got the sense that they were truly tolerant or actually wanted that animal to have its place in their system, and they weren't just being tolerant because they didn't have a choice otherwise?
No, I think they are, in fact, truly tolerant. They have a respect for all life. And in one case, we were working with some herdsmen who was suffering pretty severe predation. And it was really a loss, a real blow to this family. And they invited a nearby monk. And the monk came to their house and stayed with them for 4 or 5 days. And I don't know if pray is the right word, meditated. They tried to figure out a way to deal with this, you know, predation respectfully. And in the end, I was absolutely blown away that the family went out and was carving prayers in stone with small chisels. And this went on for weeks. It was really surprising. In a few cases, I filmed snow leopards walking by these prayers that had been carved into stone in the mountain. And it was just shocking to me at what a different approach we have in Wyoming. And, you know, I grew up on a ranch. I know when people are dealing with predators, the discussion's usually around what caliber, you know, a weapon people use to take them out. So it was really, really humbling to see a very different approach.
That's Shane Moore, who captured the first ever footage of snow leopard cubs in the wild for two films, Born in China and Ghost of the Mountains. Thanks, Shane.
Thank you.
For the last 30 years, Stephen Walt has watched American and world politics. He's a foreign policy expert and a historian of the Cold War. He visited the University of Wyoming as part of the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholars Program, and he joined me to discuss how the current political climate is different from the Cold War.
The fundamental difference, it seems to me, is that in the Cold War, the United States was faced with a genuine peer competitor, a country that was not as economically powerful as we were, the Soviet Union, but it was a continent-sized superpower. It had a lot of military power. It had an ideology that attracted millions of sympathizers around the world in other countries, people who, you know, were confirmed communists, a real genuine rival. And there isn't such a state like that today. Russia today is a pale shadow of the former Soviet Union. The United States has a 17 trillion economy. Russia's economy is less than 2 trillion. So Russia, although the relationship is now quite troubled in various ways, is not the kind of rival that we faced back then. What we face instead are a bunch of weaker powers, but in some respects troublesome weaker powers, and North Korea is a perfect illustration of that. North Korea is by most measures largely a failure, but it does have now nuclear weapons, which makes it extremely difficult for us to deal with and very difficult to put any meaningful pressure on.
International security and foreign policy are sort of experiencing a unique moment right now where I think a lot of people are maybe more tuned in than they have been in the past. They're paying attention. People are keeping up with what's happening with North Korea, China, Russian attempts to influence American politics. What are you, as an expert, most closely watching?
That's a great question. Again, as my other answers sort of indicated, I think over the longer term, I'm worrying mostly about whether or not the United States can retain its current set of strategic partnerships in Asia. So our treaty with Japan, our relationship with South Korea, repairing a badly frayed relationship with the Philippines right now, and then hanging on to the ties we have with, say, Singapore, with Australia, and continuing to build a more cooperative relationship with India. If the United States is worried about the balance of power with China, then we're going to need allies in Asia. We can't be in Asia without partners there. And anything we do that starts to undermine those relationships, it seems, is not good for us long term.
You've been monitoring foreign policy and the United States' place in the world for decades now. You have a long view of where we've come from. And I think every moment in some ways feels pressing. Is there something fundamentally different about this moment that we're in right now?
The one biggest difference, and it's the obvious one, is I don't think we've ever had a president who is as skeptical of a lot of the relationships and practices that the United States has followed really since World War II. Whether or not that's right or wrong, people can disagree with. But he is an outlier, as are a number of the people sort of politically associated with him. And how that plays out, you know, to some degree, remains to be seen. I think the other thing that I am struck with, though, is that in some respects, it's the demise of expertise, and even expertise inside Washington. This is somewhat paradoxical because, you know, there are more think tanks there now than there ever were before. Their bureaucracies are bigger. There are more trained experts who have master's degrees and PhDs and things like that. But then if you look in Congress and if you look in some other key positions, these are people who actually don't know very much about foreign policy. We also have fewer and fewer members of Congress who ever served in the military and have any real expertise in that, cannot be as well-informed critics or well-informed just questioners of military policy because they didn't serve themselves and they haven't really studied it. So I worry that we still have this very ambitious international agenda where the United States is going to have its fingers in lots of different places. But oddly enough, the people who have to make the key decisions there don't know as much.
You are a political realist. Is there any glimpse, though, or any spark of optimism that you can find in this moment?
I have several sources of optimism, at least about the United States. The United States is still an extraordinarily fortunate country. We have a providential location here in the Western Hemisphere. We have no enemies nearby. There are no countries with nuclear weapons anywhere near our soil. We have still the world's most productive economy. We have a rich continent still filled with natural resources. We have the world's best system of higher education. We have been better than any other society in the history of the planet at assimilating people from other parts of the world and making them successful Americans. Dozens of top 10, top 20 companies that were founded by immigrants and whatever. So there's a lot going for this country, and we still have a very innovative sectors of the economy in a variety of places. Almost any country in the world would like to trade places with us, and we ought to get up every morning and remember that and then go out and say, having said that, we're not perfect and there's some things we can improve, there's some things we can fix, et cetera. So I think we have all the potential to do very well in the world and do very well for ourselves. And it will be a tragedy if through a series of self-inflicted wounds, we don't do that.
Stephen Walt is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He visited the University of Wyoming as part of the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholars Program. Thank you so much, Stephen.
It's a pleasure talking with you.
To hear more from Stephen Walt about the state of American democracy and how Americans might overcome a polarized political climate, visit our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Coming up, we'll learn about efforts to get UW students to react to sexual violence and some Native American remains return home. This is Open Spaces.
Stay informed, support news you can trust, and programs like Open Spaces on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. Our fall fun drive kicks off this weekend, and you can be among our early pledgers. Visit our secure website at wyomingpublicmedia.org and connect on the donate link. We have a few new thank you gifts this fall you can choose from for your support. Thank you.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. In August, we aired a story about a University of Wyoming student who filed a Title IX complaint with the federal government about the handling of her sexual assault. Since then, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos initiated an overhaul of the federal guidelines concerning sexual violence enforcement on college campuses. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson explores UW's efforts to prevent sexual violence.
At the University of Wyoming, all incoming students are required to take an online course about sexual assault and relationship violence. But that doesn't mean they actually pay attention.
It's like when you're blind to it and you don't have to deal with it, it's so easy not to.
Emily Alexander is a senior now. She says very little from those first few weeks of new student orientation activities actually stuck.
I mean, I obviously had no idea that was going to happen to me a couple months later, but I also had no interest in, like, learning about it.
On October 30th, 2014, Emily was raped at an off-campus party. She knew the guy. He was a freshman, too.
And now I'm, like, so fired up about, like, wanting to be that, like, reminder of how it happens.
In retrospect, she can connect what led to her assault with things that sexual violence prevention efforts say to watch out for.
We played a drinking game.
There were about six people playing, but the guy kept targeting her in the game.
And everyone went around, and you bounced a coin. You could bounce it in your cup, which means you were safe, or you could bounce it in somebody else's cup. And there were like four or five times that he like hit it in my cup.
And he'd been insistent that Emily come to the party.
He had texted my friend also before we had even gone over. And he was like, are you guys gonna bring Emily tonight? Is Emily gonna come? He was making sure that I was coming.
And things were okay until her friends decided to leave. There was no sober driver, so Emily stayed at the party. She went into a bedroom to charge her cell phone so she could text a sober friend for a ride.
And he, like, quickly followed me in, shut and locked the door. I remember hearing it click.
And what happened to Emily that night is all too familiar. The majority of assaults on college campuses involve alcohol and are perpetrated by someone who already knows the victim. Emily wrestled with feeling like it was her fault. But no one else saw the signs or stepped up to intervene. And the idea behind UW's prevention efforts is that they will.
We would like students to step in and say, hey, you two just met and you seem to be getting along, but we're going to go ahead and take one of you home. Exchange cell phone numbers. You guys can text later.
That's Sean Blackburn, now Vice President of Student Affairs and formerly the Dean of Students.
If we can help students intervene more often, be aware of those definitions of consent, be aware of alcohol, and help each other out more, I think we can make a big improvement in this area.
To get a sense of how today's freshmen respond to all this sexual violence training, I worked with sociology student Carlos Gonzalez. He gathered these reactions from his freshman dorm.
From my experience and things that I've heard from other people, they don't really take it very seriously.
And that's what he heard over and over again.
Honestly, like, I'm a big advocate for, like, sexual assault awareness and everything, but if it hadn't prevented me from registering for spring classes, I probably would not have done it.
It was kind of an overview of everything. It was drinking from a fire hose.
Realistically, you know, you're going to learn some stuff, but there are some people where it's not even going to change their mind.
And this response doesn't surprise Megan Selheim. She runs Stop Violence, the campus office focused on prevention and survivor advocacy.
Especially a school in Wyoming where there's a lot of value given to personal choice and freedom, it can be difficult to mandate a whole bunch of things.
Selheim says as a prevention specialist, she knows that if students feel like they have to do something, they don't take in that information the same way. So her strategy is to make sure students hear the information in a lot of different ways. Last weekend, those efforts took Selheim to the Cowboys game against the Rainbow Warriors. Selheim and a team of volunteers passed out brown and gold beads and encouraged students to sign the Step Up Pledge.
And then all you do is name and email, make sure it's legible.
Asking them to intervene when they see risky behavior. And in exchange, their names were entered into a raffle. Out in the stands, students Natasha, Jenny, and Zoe shamefully admit that they'd signed up because there was a chance to win $100.
Which is a really bad reason to do that.
But it is an issue they take seriously, which they attribute to the fact that they're not from here.
Like back home in England, it's a much bigger deal. Like people are much more aware of it.
At home, they say there's less shame around sexual assault and that their peers respect their boundaries better.
Like it took me a long time to trust my male friends here. And they're really lovely. It's just how they're like being brought up is different here.
In England, all children are taught about safe and healthy relationships starting at age 4. As they get older, that curriculum starts to address sex and consent. And that points to a huge challenge the university faces. The U.S. does not have comprehensive sex ed. It's left up to the states. And in Wyoming, it's handled on a district-by-district basis.
It's really hard to start from scratch when kids are coming in and they're 18 years old.
Megan Selheim from Stop Violence again.
Because there has already been so much time where they have learned through media, internalized from peers, and just their own experience what is and is not okay and how you do and do not engage with people in intimate settings, intimate relationships.
But Selheim says despite those challenges, she sees the culture at UW starting to shift. While the number of reported assaults has jumped from 9 in 2014 to 19 in 2016, Selheim says that's not a bad thing. It doesn't mean that there's been an increase in sexual violence, but rather, she says, a willingness to call it out, which paves the way for more meaningful prevention. In a future story, we'll revisit Emily Alexander's story and hear from other survivors about how UW responded to their reports of sexual misconduct. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
In 1881, 15 children from the Wind River Indian Reservation were sent to the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. All were the children of chiefs, sent bearing gifts for their white educators. But only 6 of those children survived the experience. 3 were buried in the school cemetery. Now, as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, the Northern Arapaho tribe has exhumed those graves so they could bring their ancestors home to be reburied.
On the Wind River Reservation, on the far edge of a windswept cemetery filled with white crosses and colorful flowers, a fresh mound blends in with all the others. It's surrounded with stones and gifts.
Little buckskin horse.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's a bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
And some tobacco pouches.
Olivia Washington bends down and arranges the gifts around a metal plaque with the name Horse. In the 19th century, Horse was the son of Chief Washington, and he was Olivia Washington's ancestor, only 9 when he was put on a cattle train to Carlisle Indian School. It's now an Army War College. In August, Olivia and her son Josiah traveled to Carlisle to see Horse's grave unearthed.
Josiah and myself went and sat in the cemetery so that we could watch the entire time. And, you know, we just kind of sat and said our prayers and talked a little.
Olivia says the War College showed respect and sensitivity to the tribe during the two-week visit. But Olivia says it was traumatic to arrive at Carlisle because of the agonizing stories of physical and sexual abuse that survivors brought home. Yuvna Soldierwolf is the former Northern Arapaho Tribal Historic Preservation Officer who finally convinced the Army to let the tribe exhume the graves. Both Soldierwolf and Olivia Washington say it was the tour of the school prison that really brought home the reality of what children endured there. As Soldierwolf walked down a hall.
En route was the... Sorry, hold on. was the jail. We saw the jail.
Washington says that's where they held children when they were bad.
What they considered bad was the child spoke their native language, or like any child, maybe they didn't want to go to bed.
Washington and Soldier Wolf were on the same tour, along with tribal elders.
Having elders go through that tour was really difficult for them because they've gone to boarding school themselves.
As upsetting as it was, Soldier Wolf worked her whole life to go on this trip. When she was a girl, the federal government passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, and her tribal elders started talking about getting their ancestors back. She came across a book on NAGPRA.
I was like a teenager, and I was like, wow. When I got to the end of it, I was like, this empowered me. This book empowered me.
Soldier Wolf was empowered to use what she'd learned about NAGPRA to demand the graves be opened. This was personal. Her father's uncle, Little Chief, was buried there too. At first, the Army said no. That was a few years ago.
And they basically kind of told me, well, this is a historic site. This is a tranquil site. It's a place where we honor Native Americans. And I thought, wow, I thought we were past this. Native Americans aren't out for exhibit. We're not for sale.
But after she wrote a second letter, the Army began working with her. It took months of moving up through military protocol, but finally the Army said yes. It was the first time they'd ever agreed to let a tribe exhume a grave. And the Army paid for everything, even the family's airfare. They brought the best archaeologists to examine the bones. The first two, Horses and Little Chiefs, looked good, males of about the right age. But when they got to the third of Little Plume, Olivia Washington.
They found that there were two sets. The only way they knew that basically was they had two right hip bones.
The bones had to be put back and a new headstone placed there that read, Unknown. Soldier Wolf was devastated. She turned to an elder for comfort.
It was just so hard. I literally just fell in her arms and cried for a long time.
In the early 1900s, the cemetery had been moved from its original site to a much smaller plot to make room for a parking lot, mixing up some of the remains. Soldier Wolf says even the Army was disappointed, many of them in tears, as the tribe left with only two children instead of three. Back in Wyoming, people turned out in large numbers for the ceremonies.
We treated it as a funeral because he and the other child were never given the traditional funerary rites that we give every one of our tribal members, you know, to show him we honor him, we love him, we still care for you as this little boy who's coming back.
It's unclear whether the Army will continue to search for the third child, Little Plume. The War College declined to be interviewed for this story. But Christine Dindisi McCleave, director of the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, says the Army has made a small step to healing the historical trauma of the boarding school era.
It's great that the Army War College was willing to go through this process voluntarily instead of, you know, having to be drugged through a legal process using NAGPRA.
She says the government still needs to release the records of what really happened to the children. She says her organization submitted a Freedom of Information request, but has received nothing.
We think that's because they don't have full records. They didn't even keep good accounting of who these children were, where they came from.
Everyone interviewed agreed it's time for the government to cooperate and find what records exist wherever they are. Olivia Washington says it's frustrating that Horse's death certificate says the cause of death was only death. Her son Josiah agrees.
We just would like the truth. We deserve to know now. And that doesn't just go for our tribe, it goes for everybody else's tribe too.
Yuvna Soldierwolf now works for the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. She says in November, they're inviting tribes from around the country to Minneapolis to learn how they too can reclaim their ancestors' remains from boarding school cemeteries. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards. Coming up, a conversation with Miss Wyoming USA. This is Open Spaces. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces on Wyoming Public Radio, connecting Wyoming with NPR news, music, and cultural programming. Sustaining and renewing members provide the largest source of income for Wyoming Public Radio. You can be a part of that team with a contribution in any amount. Keep Wyoming connected with your pledge online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The Equality State Policy Center has launched a new effort called the People's Review. It's intended to let the public know how their legislators voted on key legislation supported by social justice, conservation, and labor groups in Wyoming. The director of the ESPC is Phoebe Stoner. She explains what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, so the People's Review is a vote record. And we couldn't feature all the bills from the session because we wanted this to be kind of accessible visibly and kind of striking. So we wanted to kind of focus it on key bills that were relevant to our vision for Wyoming. And when I say we, I mean our coalition. So some of them are bills that ESPC was driving, and some of them are bills that are related to our other coalition members. So we through our coalition, chose nine bills, and we're publishing the vote records of lawmakers on those issues. And we wanted to reach as many people as possible. So we are really expanding our ways of communication. So we're going to do three different versions of this. There's going to be a physical print report version that's available. And then there's going to be an online version on our website. And then there's also going to be full page colored ads taken out in newspapers across the state regionally. And we wanted to break it up into regions so folks wouldn't have to sort through to see or find the individual who's representing them.
So is the idea on the ads is you'd say, in, let's say you're in Casper, you would break down the individual legislators and just show in an advertisement or something how they voted on key things?
That's exactly right. So, for example, in Natrona County, we're taking out a double ad in the Casper Star Tribune to target folks and constituents in those regions. And then focusing on the lawmakers from that area. And it's basically a matrix of those individuals with their pictures and district numbers, and then their votes on those nine bills. And we space was a limitation on the newspaper ad, but we tried to include a description of the bill, what our stance was on it, and the ultimate fate, so whether it passed or failed.
Mm-hmm. What legislation are you targeting or wanting to tell folks about?
Mm-hmm. So for us, our issues relate to transparent government, fair elections, thriving communities. So a lot of the bills we have on here, for example, automatic restoration of the right to vote, that's related to fair elections, recording of legislative meetings. That one was critical to us. It actually failed this session. We wanted to highlight that since it's such a basic act of transparency. And then others are more related to our coalition members. We're highlighting the school finance bill, the omnibus education program that was such a contentious and complicated issue, trying to distill it down to a format where folks can hopefully understand it. And American Indian Education Program.
All this information is going to be available starting next week?
Correct. We are launching this effort on October 1st, which is this upcoming Sunday, and we'll be running in newspapers throughout this upcoming week, and the online version will be available at that time too.
Phoebe Stoner is the executive director of the Equality State Policy Center. Changing gears, earlier this month, Callie Mae Bishop was crowned Miss Wyoming USA. The Casper native had sought the title for a number of years. In real life, Bishop is a yoga instructor, rock climber, and serves beer. In other words, the perfect Miss Wyoming. She says the victory is a dream come true.
Well, ever since I was a little girl, I wanted to be a princess and a teacher, so I thought the job of Miss Wyoming USA would fit perfectly. And I remember 8 years old, watching Miss USA, looking up to these women. They're confident, they're entrepreneurs, they're getting stuff done and serving their communities. So I honestly just wanted to be them one day, and I'm blessed to be in that space now.
Now, you tried this as a teen.
Correct.
And so talk a little bit about that experience.
Yes, I was Miss Wyoming Teen USA exactly a decade ago, and that experience really taught me that it wasn't about the crown, it's what you do with a crown. And so I was active with best buddies, I was teaching dance classes, and traveling around the state trying to be a good role model, or at least the role model that I needed when I was younger.
What kinds of preparation goes into this?
It's kind of the Olympics of beauty pageants. The Miss USA organization is fantastic, but there are three areas of competition. So I had to train for an interview, a swimsuit, and an evening gown. And the best way you can train for that is to be mentally, emotionally, spiritually resistant and be able to go with the flow.
How do you see yourself as somebody that wants to represent women and different things that are very important to women these days? There's a lot, still a lot of interesting issues in our own state about wage disparity, that types of things, some types of discrimination. How do you hope to combat stuff like that and use your title to maybe make a difference?
Absolutely. I think the best way you can do that is if your actions inspire others to do more, dream more, learn more. John Quincy Adams said this, and that's one of my favorite quotes. So I have the luxury or the privilege of using my social media, of being active in my community and using my voice. And we haven't quite met equality, especially with the wage. It's, what is it, 70 or 80 cents to every dollar that a man makes. And so just declaring these things that women deserve and being a good role model is the best way that I can do that.
Does it bother you if some people would wonder if this is sexist to be involved in something like this?
I see that the Miss Universe organization is an organization ran by women, for women, to empower women. And so that to me is feminism, is women lifting other women up. And so if they were to say it's sexist, I would say, well, let me share a little bit more with you. And I think that hopefully I could persuade them to see it in a different light.
So what are you going to be doing? You're preparing, obviously, for the national competition, but what happens between now and then?
A very similar process to what it looked like to get here. I'll be training physically in the gym a lot. I will be doing mock interviews. I will be active in my community. And for me, a lot of it was reshaping my mental dialogue and the visualization process and positive affirmations. Because to be honest, you would never know this, but I struggled with self-esteem when I was younger and depression. And so my preparation is just making sure I'm the healthiest, best version of myself for Miss USA, which will be in about 6 to 7 months. Fox Network usually lets us know 3 to 4 weeks beforehand.
Oh, so you get about 3 to 4 weeks to know when this competition.
Correct. I like to think that I'm on call at all times.
That's a good way to go. Again, visiting with Callie Bishop, who is your Miss Wyoming USA. So this was, can I just bring this up? This was an interesting year for you because you knew you wanted to go for this, but then you had your father pass away. Mm-hmm. How much did that inspire you in the weeks leading up to this?
150%. In my dad's last year, he had the most to complain about, and he never once said, this is hard. He always woke up and he tried and he gave it his best. And he would always ask me if I was happy. And I thought it was such an interesting question, but this title, this job makes me happy. And the idea of connecting with other young women thrills me. And so anytime that I feel overworked or tired, I thought of him, and I still think of him every single day when I wake up. And his hard work and commitment and competitiveness definitely lives in me, and I will bring that to Miss USA.
You told me that he went to every competition and always yelled, "That's my girl."
Oh yes. Standing. I was always so embarrassed, but he was just always so proud of me, and he really wanted to be there for me. And he said, even if they roll me out on a dolly, I'm going to be there. But I do know that he was there with me that day and every step of the way. So I'm so grateful to have this dream, his dream for me and my dream for myself, finally be a reality.
So you're excited about the event as it comes up. What are some things you want to accomplish here in this state before the national competition?
My focus is going to be working with as many women as possible. I, of course, want to work with kids. I love working with children. And I used to run an after-school program for kids with disabilities. So I'd like to continue to do that work. I'd like to continue to work with the SAFE Project. I myself am a survivor of an abusive relationship. And so I just want to give back what I've been given. I've been given a lot. I'm very privileged. I have a lot of knowledge and passion. And my goal is to spread that throughout my state and hopefully the United States as Miss USA.
Well, it sounds like we've picked a perfect person to carry this title. I was telling Callie off the air that if I was her, I would be wearing my crown around all the time. Or are you planning on following that advice?
I definitely want to get the mileage in. I only get 1 year, so taking advantage of that time. I probably won't sleep in it, but.
Okay. Well, Callie Bishop, a tremendous pleasure having you. I understand this was your first media interview. Thank you so much for joining us on Open Space.
Oh, it was a pleasure being here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. You can hear this program again on our website or by signing up for our podcast.
You can also listen to individual segments or share them from our website, which is at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Please support our Wyoming news coverage with your pledge on that website. We can't do shows like Open Spaces or cover state news without your support.
Again, that's at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.